Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. I'm your host, Delcherie Gladden. On this episode, I have Kirk Ellis, and he's going to be talking about his book, Ride Lonesome, through UNM Press. Kirk, go ahead and introduce yourself first.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure to talk about films I like and people who mentored me throughout the early stages of my career, something that doesn't always happen these days. I've been a writer for most of my adult working in Los Angeles and then in London, largely with trade publications like Hollywood Reporter and Moving Pictures. But beginning in the early 90s, I transitioned into what I call a natural cycle of corruption into screenwriting and producing. I became known for doing a series of biographical or historically based dramas, ranging from shows about the Beach Boys to the Three Stooges to Judy Garland to Anne Frank, ultimately working on a show for HBO with Paul Giamatti and Laura Linney about our second president, John Adams, which was a terrific experience and won the Emmy that year for Best Limited Series. And I've been going back and forth between journalism and production for many, many years. But for the last 20 or so of those, it's been pretty much full-time writing and producing, most recently doing a show called The Statesman, Franklin in Paris, which we shot all of last year in Paris with Michael Douglas as Benjamin Franklin for Apple Plus TV. And I was the showrunner and one of the writers and executive producers of that show.
Wonderful. You've got tons of experience in a variety of things, and I am excited to talk to you about all of that and your book and your connection to it. I grew up on a lot of Westerns. I was not familiar with this one. When I saw it in the UNM catalog, I was like, Westerns? That'll give me a good reason to go watch one. And I have to say, I'm so sad that I just now got to know this film because I watched it with my boyfriend and we loved it. It was really different, especially for the time period. But I was really impressed with how tight it is. Like, it's so short compared to what we get today. But there's such a complete, wonderful story in it. So before I go on for too long, give listeners just an idea of the book and the film that you're talking about in the book and a brief idea to get people interested and let them know what we're talking about.
Well, I mean, take heart, you're not alone, because when people think of Westerns, whether they are Western fans or people who are interested in older movies, they tend to think of these canonical titles like Stagecoach, Red River, The Searchers, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Maybe some of them remember the Anthony Mann, Jimmy Stewart collaborations like Winchester 73 or The Man from Laramie shot here in New Mexico. But there was this remarkable series of Westerns made as Hollywood was transitioning from the studio era into this more free-range independent era of the 60s and 70s. They were done on minuscule budgets, on shooting schedules that were at best 2 weeks long, by Bud Bedeker and largely Burt Kennedy, his writer, that are known collectively as the renowned series of Westerns. That title comes from the company name of the producers, Randolph Scott, RA, and Harry Joe Brown, Noun, Renowned Productions. These were remarkable movies that enabled the transition from that classical period of John Ford and Raoul Walsh and into the era of Peckinpah and Arthur Penn with Little Big Man and the films that followed, because they looked at the Western from a much more cynical and a much more existential point of view. But because they were low-budget films, they were not then and are not now as well-known as they should be. But because they were off the radar and done for such little money, it enabled Burt and Bud and Randolph Scott and their collaborators to really get away with everything they wanted to do in terms of redefining that genre for a new audience.
Yeah, I was shocked. We watched it first and then I started in reading that this was filmed in 13 days for half a million, about.
Under half a million.
I was just like, oh my gosh, like I can't even imagine how they did that and how they got everything to come together so well with such limited resources, really, both time and money and personnel, it sounds like. Talk a little bit about scheduling the shooting to kind of get the extras offset quickly so they didn't have to pay them any extra days. Well, it's very efficient.
Sure. I mean, Bud Dedeker said throughout the time we knew each other in the interviews he gave before and after the period that one of the things that happens when you're working on low budget, limited schedule is that you really focus your attention. There's really no time to improvise. There's no time to think about what you're going to do. You have to get it done. So you're doing the same work you would do on an epic feature in 1/10 of the time and 1/100th, if not 1,000th, of the budget. And that's why these films are incredibly tight. I mean, we live in an era where even Sex in the City sequel is an almost 3-hour long film. And you're dealing with this entire series of films, and Ride, Lonesome for Me is the pinnacle of this set of six films that last 72 minutes. That is an hour and 12 minutes. It's shorter than an average dinner in Santa Fe, particularly post-COVID. You're getting a remarkably tight narrative told with incredible efficiency with a minimum of wastage. You were talking about getting the extras off screen. There are no extras in these films. There is only in very few of them is there even a town that we normally associate with Westerns. These are existential films made at the height of the atomic age, where all of the tropes of Westerns, the lawman bent on revenge, those kinds of things, take on this really kind of apocalyptic cast, where the journey is a kind of ritual. People start and finish before ever getting anywhere. And with this film in particular, the quest is buried so far in the past that it's been almost forgot by the participants. And that really puts the whole Western mythos up for grabs. Is it history? Is it an American mentality? Is it a psychological condition? I mean, all of that really plays into it.
It really does. And you talk about it in the book. But, you know, like I said, I grew up watching a lot of Westerns. My great uncle, Cal Schroem, was an actor around that time and in a lot of also very low budget films that we had fun watching. And seeing kind of that really classic cowboy Western kind of movie, a lot of similar plot lines, similar characters. I kind of went into watching this and reading thinking it was going to be along those same lines. And like you mentioned in the book, with Burt Kennedy, his characterization of the hero, who's a little bit more of an anti-hero, and even the other characters, you're not always sure what side of the, you know, black hat, white hat, they're kind of various shades of gray, that there's really so much depth to the characters. And even in the story, like, it just isn't the typical Western that you would expect leading up to this time period. And I found that really fascinating, both watching and then reading as you talked about it, just that process of breaking out of some of those molds and conventions of the time and developing these really fascinating characters.
So all of what you're talking about is a product of the characters of the men who created them. Bert Kennedy, who wrote four of the films in the series, was somebody who came out of World War II. Bert had served in the 1st Cavalry in the Pacific and was one of the participants in one of the great and kind of unheralded prison raid of World War II, where he and his group helped liberate a civilian prisoner of war camp outside Manila that was notorious for its poor treatment of civilians, largely American and British, who were caught behind enemy lines with the outbreak of World War II and after Pearl Harbor. And so Bert saw a lot of death and killing when he was serving. And he comes out of the war working for John Wayne at Bad Jack Productions doing Western scripts. And he's not interested in that traditional dichotomy between good and evil. He knows that human beings, men especially, possess both in equal measure. So he creates a Western hero who doesn't talk a lot, who's modest to the point of mystery about where he's been or what he's seen and who he's killed, and matches him up with an antagonist. You can't call them villains, because in these films, the hero and villain of a traditional Western are equally matched, and it's very easy to see that the hero could be his antithesis quite easily. And then you have Bud Bedeker, who is truly one of the maverick personalities in Hollywood, a collegiate athlete who's injured, who is prescribed a trip around the Western Hemisphere, disembarks early on in Mexico, attends a bullfight, is amazed by the ritual quality and the athleticism of that event, and decides, that's what I'm going to do. So against his parents' wishes, as Bud said, the only red-haired Presbyterian bullfighter in Mexico, a bit of an oddity, but he's injured quite gravely quite early in his career, comes back at his mother's insistence, really, to Hollywood, becomes the technical advisor for a bullfighting movie, the 1940 remake of Blood and Sand with Tyrone Power, gets the movie bug, and works his way up through the ranks as an assistant director to George Stevens. In that capacity, takes on one of the legendary figures of Hollywood, Harry Cohn, bans him from one of George Stevens' sets, getting himself called on the carpet to find an admiring studio executive saying, kid, you got guts, but can you be a director? And parlays that into this career, but is always a maverick in what he does and is always going against the grain, often to his own personal and professional detriment. But he and Bert meet over Bert's very first script in this series, a wonderful movie made in 1956 called Seven Men from Now, co-starring Randolph Scott and Lee Marvin, is one of the great renowned bad guys, and they have a similar personality and similar bond, and they're able to work essentially outside the system for this small period of time, under 4 years, to do these amazing Westerns that are the back half of double bills in America, but are instantly discovered in Europe and become known as these new Westerns to this group of critics like Francois Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard and Claude Chabrol and André Bazin, the sort of dean of European film criticism, and then rediscovered by a whole new generation of people, including me. And I met them both when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Southern California and staged one of the very first Bud Bedeker retrospectives. And they were revelations to an audience in 1982. And they've now come back into circulation through a recent re-release on Criterion. And it's just great with the book. I was talking about this in New York at a book event at the Bryant Park outside the New York Public Library, that these Westerns are constantly being rediscovered. And the book is either, people either see the Westerns first and then read the book, or they read the book as you did and went, I've never heard of these movies, and go back and look at them on Amazon or through the Criterion re-release. And Bird and Bud are now getting their moment in the sun, which I find immensely gratifying.
I think that's one of those signs of classic literature, art, film, whatever it is, of it continuously speaks to people and they connect with it. And it's those things that are just so universally relatable. You know, you have this main character who you really don't get a lot of information about until the very end of the show, but you feel yourself connecting with him because you're just like, there's some reason he's going through all of this, and you know it's a good one. You don't know what it is, but like you can feel that intense need that he has to complete this journey that he's on. And this was one of those that could watch it bunches of time. And I have the other films in the series on my list of things to watch. But I love that it keeps getting rediscovered because it's well worth it. I think it'll continue to keep getting rediscovered because it does have that just classic nature to it where any generation is going to be able to relate to these characters, I think.
Well, I think that there's a reason for that. And I mean, popular arts are difficult because they're often a product of their time. And sometimes they don't date well. They don't speak to a contemporary audience in the way they once did. But these movies do. And I think the reason is if there were a word for the renowned films, that word would be elemental. They fit everything down to basics. And the best of these films are shot in this remarkable landscape known as the Alabama Hills, which exist in Lone Pine, California, halfway between L.A. and Lake Tahoe. And Bud didn't discover that landscape, but he is as identified with the Alabama Hills and Lone Pine as John Ford is with Monument Valley. This is an area of remarkably old rock formations, these almost lunar boulders that go back millions of years that have been carved and recarved over time. And they've served as the backdrop not only for Westerns, but films like Gunga Din and The Charge of the Light Brigade and Django Unchained over the decades. But Bud really knew how to use them because they are sun-scorched, windswept, and almost apocalyptic. And because they had no money to work with and they had very few shooting days, you really had to start thinking of these stories as not traditional, but existential meditations on what it meant to walk through this life in the West. You look at the opening of Ride Lonesome, where Randolph Scott's character literally seems to materialize out of the landscape. You don't really see him until he's there. With this past that you don't know and a future that is indeterminate. So there's a reason the French really glommed onto these films because it's very much like Albert Camus and The Stranger in its narrative development. It is defined as you go. There is no backstory. There is no exposition. All of those, by the way, are overrated qualities in television that lead to over-length and series and miniseries that have endless episodes that don't seem to have a point. These films really strip things down to the bare elements.
They really do. And I have to say, watching this film with someone who's gone to film school makes it even more interesting. My boyfriend, Chris, went to film school. He's a prosecutor now. But it was so much fun watching it with him. That opening scene, he was fascinated by. And then when the horses crash into the corral, and there's a scene where the riders are coming up and they're backlit by the dust cloud that the horses are kicking up. And there were so many of those moments watching them with him that he understood how difficult that was and how many of those scenes were in one long shot. And I love watching film. I don't know the details of how they're made. So it really added even more to my watching experience to have him there and learning about the process and the things that he was impressed by. And then being able to go back and read the book. And I'm like, wow, yeah. Like it was really just amazing how well they used everything that they had. And that tight schedule was just crazy to me. I can't imagine filming something in such a short amount of time. But like you said, the landscape.
So much of what happens in production is instinctive. And many books about film are written by people, and they're great books, don't get me wrong, but they're written by people who don't no film sets, and they don't know how these things sometimes occur. It always comes from an academic point where you're taking the end result and trying to work backward. Whereas my perspective of doing this was somebody who not only knew the creators, but has worked most of his adult life in this industry and knows how films are put together. So we now, as a result of a generation past Burton Budd, think of films as storyboards and a lot of pre-planning, and you've got all these drawings to show you and everybody on the team what you're doing. That's not how these guys worked. Budd wasn't a prep director. He wasn't one of those directors who came to the set every morning, and when he was doing these films in Lodestein, he didn't take a car into the set. He rode the car from the Dow Hotel in the center of Lodestein up to the Alabama Hills. It's not that far away. And he would go onto the set, and he'd look around, and they'd look at what scenes they were shooting, and he'd come up with the shots that day. That's more common than the other side. But he would also know that you're shooting a minimum amount of footage. So there isn't enough film for the studio to then come in and say, well, we can cut the film a different way. That's not how these guys work. They would come up each day with what they were going to do, and then they would shoot it, and there wouldn't be that much left over for anybody to play around with. And you could do that when you weren't on the lot, and none of Red Lodestein was shot on the Columbia lot, the studio that financed to release these films. It was all shot on location. So there were never any executives coming up getting in people's way. Now, that isn't to say that you were so fixed in what you were doing that there was no room left to maneuver. One of the great beauties of these films, when we look at them in retrospect, is the number of people who started their careers in them. And if you look at the people who played the, quote, bad guys, in Seven Men from Nowhere, you've got Lee Marvin. In The Tall T, you've got Richard Boone. In Comanche Station, the film that ends the series, you've got Claude Akins. In this film, you have not only one, but two incredibly likable antagonists. Mm-hmm. One played by Earl Roberts. This was, I think, his third film. He'd been an acclaimed stage actor in New York. He'd won Drama Desk Awards for his performance of Shakespeare. But as often happens, because of his background, his accent, he got typecast in Westerns. And Purnell Roberts is wonderful in this film and parlayed it into the role as what became known as the liberal Cartwright on Bonanza. But as his sidekick in his very first film, you have a barely 20-year-old James Coburn. spends most of the movie wearing red DVD underwear, and shambling along, wisecracking to Purnell Roberts. They're very much like Oliver Hardy and Stan Laurel in this movie. But Randolph Scott was such a generous performer, and we can certainly talk about Randolph Scott as an actor and personality later on, but he recognized this kid had something. So one night, he and Bud and Bert are having steak at the Lone Restaurant in Lone Pine, and Randolph Scott says, you know, who's that young fella in the red underwear I've been doing scenes with today? And Burt Kennedy said, that's a kid named James Coburn. And Randolph Scott said, let's give him some more lyrics. I like working with him. That night, Burt and Bud retreated to the hotel room, and I always like to think with a bottle of Jack Daniels, and thought about a scene they could write, and they came up with this remarkable moment between Purnell Roberts and James Coburn, where they're talking about what they're going to do. How are they going to get rid of Randolph Scott, take over his prisoner, who has this bounty on him, this amnesty, that could give them a fresh start, and what are they going to do? And Bud knocked it off in this one remarkable take, a couple of different versions of it, but one shot, and it's always the scene in the movie that galvanizes an audience onto the side of the outlaws. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but Bud sent one of those takes to John Sturges, who at the time they were shooting Ride Lonesome was casting the movie that became The Magnificent Seven. And that's how James Coburn came to be that laconic knife expert. And that made his career as a movie star.
That's incredible. They not only as a group, like one of the quotes in there is just said, like, you know, it was the right people at the right time and they came together and did amazing things, but they really seem to have just had an eye for who to bring together with them and what was going to connect with people. Like, just watching it and reading your book, that was something that just really stood out a lot, was how much the group as a whole, the production of it, just how it went through the series of six movies, really just achieved something that doesn't seem to happen very often in any genre, or really just in a lot of arenas. I don't think you see this kind of working together so well and collaboration and just identifying what needs to happen in what way, in the same way that it did here. I was just really struck by that.
Well, we it is called the motion picture industry for a reason. We don't often, as filmmakers, as creators, get a choice in the people we're working with or the control that we have over our material. And I mean, I'm a living witness to that. Just this year and last, the show for Apple about Franklin was a remarkable moment for all of us. It was not a low-budget film. It was a $100 million enterprise with a lot of moving parts. But the creative team was remarkably in sync. And the French production designer, the French casting director, the French costume designer, everybody was on the same page, to use an overworked cliche. And when you have that kind of synchronicity on show, and you're working that far away from the centers of power, you are able to do work you cannot do otherwise. And that was the situation here as well. And the film that I wrote about, Ride Lonesome, came late in this cycle, where Bud Bedeker and Burt Kennedy and Randolph Scott had done a number of these films together, and they knew each other's working rhythms. And they knew what worked and what didn't work in the way they were trying to remake the Western. Out of that, you got this wonderful fluorescence of ideas and creativity that none of them could repeat in their individual careers. So it was all about that collaboration.
Well, I'm so glad that you experienced that on your project. And I think people who enjoy Westerns, but really anyone, I have a hard time thinking there's anyone who could watch this film and not enjoy it. But I think just looking at it from that perspective of something really just profound and worthwhile coming together and being available to people. Like I said, I'm so glad that this keeps getting rediscovered. I definitely recommend both the film and the book to go together. And I feel like I could chat with you about this forever, because I had so much fun with both, but we are actually already out of time, unfortunately. But I wanted to give you a chance before we wrap up, let people know where they can find and follow you and stay up to date on all your projects that you have going on. And yeah, just keep an eye on what you're putting out there for people.
Well, I'm remarkably analog about all of that. I've never been on Twitter, now called X, but I'm on Facebook. And the book is available on Amazon and through UNM Press. And I encourage people to, even if you don't buy the book, watch the film, watch the trailer on YouTube. It will give you a sense of a traditional, stereotypical, forgettable B-Western. And the movie is everything the trailer is not. That was one of the reasons for doing the book. But I feel grateful to the folks at UNM Press for giving me the opportunity to pay tribute to two individuals who were influential in my career, and hopefully to put people onto a series of films that may remind them that storytelling is not about how much you can tell, but how little you can tell and how well you can tell it.
I love that thought. Yes. Well, thank you, Kirk, so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, for listeners, just one more reminder, the book and the film, Ride Lonesome by Kirk Ellis through Unum Press. Thank you so much again for taking the time to chat with me about this.
I enjoyed it. Thank you again.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.